McKay. Raj is a general urinary medicine physician with particular interest in HSV infections, a recent past president of IUSTI, and his domain is clinical and international perspectives from the meeting. Raj.
Thanks very much, Hunter, and thank you to the organizers. So this is not just my work. It's the work of a team of U.S. and international IUSTI clinicians who were tasked with finding key take-home messages. And I've selected, I was absolutely inundated with stuff they wanted included in this session, and I've selected from these. So in the vaccine symposium, we learned that 9-valency vaccines are virtually upon us and that 2 doses will be as good as 3, that providing these are given to the young and that there's a high uptake vaccination program, that this process will be more effective than a cervical screening program in preventing cervical cancer. So things for us to look forward to. There were presentations from Australia that showed us what can be achieved with quadrivalent vaccine, and particularly with high uptake. Now, previously this group, Basil Donovan's group and Kit Furley's group, have shown the dramatic fall in genital warts in young women and heterosexual males in sexual health clinics. And we saw early on in the conference a presentation from Hamad Ali from the Kirby Institute that looked at that hospital inpatient surgical treatment reports for surgical clearance of genital warts, IC5. I just want to mention at this point that the organizers put considerable effort into generating some resource for scholarships, and Dr. Ali was one of our scholarships. Now, this is the historical data showing the decline in warts that has previously been published, and these are reports from sexual health clinics. What Dr. Ali's work shows is that this is actually also reflected in inpatient surgical treatment. So this vaccination policy does have a global impact. So this is the impact on girls that would have been vaccinated, and there is some additional drop in other populations. Obviously, the oldest populations, you don't see a drop, but the most dramatic drop in the girls that were vaccinated. Now, we saw a late breaker from the US showing some evidence of a decline in genital warts in the North American population. This is amongst college students. But I think we've got to be very careful about not over-interpreting high-level data. I mean, we're aware the Public Health England has shown a decline in warts in the young, and in the UK we vaccinate 12 to 23 year old girls, but we use a bivalent vaccine which doesn't actually cover the types that traditionally cause genital warts. Now, vaccination we know with HPV VLPs results in high level titers to the specific agents in there, and low level cross reacting antibodies to known vaccine strains. So there is a theory proposed that these non-specific antibodies might protect against the unexposed from developing genital warts through just cross-protection. Post WP119 offered an alternative explanation to this, that the fall, particularly in the UK, may be just due to a simple move away from genital examinations as part of asymptomatic non-examined pathways that go on to miss 2% of diagnoses in this group, and that when you model this up to a population level, you then see a decline in wart reports. A number of the clinicians were particularly impressed by this piece of work from Melbourne around detecting anal cancer early. Now, I'm sure you're aware, anal cancer in HIV-positive males is a real problem. It's commoner than cervical cancer in women and prostatic cancer in men. The benefits of HPV vaccination will not be seen in this group unless vaccination is extended to males, and even so for a number of years, since this is a problem predominantly of the over 35s. So how to manage the risk in the meantime is the question. There are advocates for the PAPS for CHAPS program and for anoscopy, but both of these require expertise and considerable expense. Now, might a low technology solution be possible? Since many of the anal cancers present late, they're extremely visible, and perhaps, and the size of presentation is linked to prognosis. So this group asked themselves a simple question. Could an annual digital rectal examination, the DARE, help detect anal cancer earlier in HIV-positive MSM? So their population is over 35, already in the system. And their conclusions were that patients found this extremely acceptable as a means of detecting anal cancer, but the major problem was that it was difficult to persuade doctors to implement DARE into HIV care. And looking at their recruitment rates, they found that a few doctors were very on board, but the majority of their ID physicians who look after HIV were very difficult, even with a financial incentive, to persuade them to take part. So the barriers are not just the patients, they're physicians as well. Hunter has warned you that I have an interest in HSV, and during some of the sessions I noticed people complaining that there wasn't that much HSV. I did find some, though. We know that HSV is a major driver for the HIV epidemic, and we know that high levels of HSV is reported in MSMs. Now, Jose Flores from Hopkins, working with groups in Chennai, looked at HSV in MSMs in India. Now, in the 18 cities studied, there are three specific subpopulations where the sexual repertoire is extremely defined in two of these three groups. And he showed that the risk of acquisition of HSV is substantially greater for those reporting receptive anal sex alone compared to those reporting isolated anal-insertive sexual practices. So this is his results. The panthi group at the top are those that practice predominantly insertive anal sex, as opposed to the coti at the bottom that practice receptive anal sex, and there's the intermediate group in the middle. The other thing that his study demonstrated, though, was that MSMs is there's considerable heterogeneity in this group. And looking at all the other social determinants, these groups have very different profiles. Now, similar work was also coming out of Latin America, presented at this conference, that within MSMs there's a number of subpopulations with different risk profiles. Some work on neonatal HSV, there were two international posters that looked at this. Now, the rates of neonatal herpes vary across the world, and the USA has the dubious privilege of having some of the highest rates published in the world, 1 in 3,000. In most of the world, we see rates of between 1 in 12 and 15,000, and there are two exceptions to this, Holland with a rate of 1 in 30,000 and the UK with a historical rate of 1 in 60,000. Poster TP76 reported on rising reports of neonatal HSV in the UK. The UK rates have now approached the European level, with 40% of cases being HSV1. So this was the conclusion from the UK data showing this trend and some of the reasons why this might be, that this may be a true rise or just improvements in diagnostic techniques. The second poster was IUSTI's Europe's 2013 European Collaborative Clinical Groups report on the management of genital herpes across the 38 countries forming this collaboration. What they demonstrated was that although clinicians understood the importance of third trimester acquisitions and the need to advise on timely cesarean section, there was little consistency in managing earlier acquisition, established disease, or serodiscordant couples where the risk was particularly high, with a male partner infected and a female susceptible. There's been a lot of work on Mycoplasma genitalium presented at this meeting, and a particularly impressive presentation by Lisa Manhart was given on Wednesday. There was compelling evidence in this presentation of the importance of Mycoplasma genitalium as a genital pathogen, and Lisa presented an unpublished meta-analysis of the role of Mycoplasma in various genital syndromes, and also anticipated the forthcoming CDC guidelines. So this is her summary slide, looking at the five syndromes that she studied, showing significant increases in risk. Now, IUSTI is also planning Mycoplasma genitalium guideline, which is currently in development. Jürgen Jensen, I think, is leading on this. TP188 was IUSTI Europe's report on the management of NGU across Europe, and this highlighted the availability of Mycoplasma tests already in many European countries, and some, like Norway, having routine testing. This has generated a number of quite difficult clinical issues, and there is widespread dissatisfaction across Europe with current azithromycin 1-gram treatment regimens. We also saw Patty Kissinger's presentation for C4, which looked at chlamydia trachomatis treatment, Now, she presented a combined analysis of three recent studies in men, 323 subjects in this combined analysis. And she looked at directly observed therapy, 1 gram azithromycin in males with proven chlamydia trachomatis. Overall, looking at the test of cure rates, she showed a 9% failure rate with confidence intervals of 5 to 22% when infection was ruled out, so re-exposure was ruled out. There were two Public Health England presentations looking at chlamydia as well. Sarah Woodall presented a paper on what national level data means in the face of an evolving set of tests and an evolving program, and the care needed in interpreting top level figures to tweak them into prevalent infection. And Kevin Dunbar looked at how having established a national program, it could be tweaked to offer better value and focus. So this is the successful program from the UK, showing how coverage improved once the rollout was completed. But what Kevin reported was that since coverage was the target for much of this program, this had in some way worked as a perverse incentive, and the program was to an extent derailed in some places with attention focused on easy to obtain tests rather than on prevalent infection. But things have been refocused now. We saw a number of presentations looking at point of care testing and its successful incorporation into clinical practice. Particularly heartening was the use of point of care testing for syphilis serology in Latin America, which Patty Garcia referred to in her plenary. And Belinda Hengel, in a poster, looked at gonorrhea and chlamydia testing in remote Aboriginal communities in Australia, showing how this is a really useful way of dealing with infection and managing it there and then. Challenges in urban settings, though, were exposed by an oral from Lindsay Atkinson, showing that there are major costs and little advantage in some settings of using point-of-care testing with current methodologies. Now, with gonorrhea, there was just far too much to present or summarize, and you're just going to have to go to the books. But Jonathan Grad's presentation was highlighted as being incredibly important by a number of the clinicians. This looked at GISP data to monitor and model GC spread, and I think is a technology of the future. Magnus Unimo detailed molecular genetics around cathexin resistance and the role of epistatic mutations, the difficulty of correlating gene presence to actual antimicrobial resistance, and the need for sequencing and research. We had two fantastic plenaries. David Lewis talked about pharyngeal infection as a reservoir in males and females, but how often this is transient and may have limited pathogenicity. And Dr. Matsumoto of Japan explained to us that in Japan that pharyngeal infection is a reservoir, particularly in sex workers, and pointed out the rather odd behavior of the gonococcus in Japan in often resulting in systemic infection, something that is getting rarer elsewhere in the world. Moving on to syphilis, the personal highlight for me was Bradley's clinical case series that he arranged in the morning. It gave me something to do with the time difference and the early morning waking, but it was absolutely fantastic, and the sessions were very well attended. There was great discussion, and it was very, very interesting. Latin American countries reported on the use of point-of-care testing to address congenital syphilis. And it was we hear so much bad news often from Latin America, but it was, very interesting to hear that in two countries, eradication levels have now been achieved, and many more are on the way. Alan Pillai of the CDC told us about the quality assurance program that the CDC organized. Now, worryingly, he presented data showing that 20% of national reference labs failed to achieve accurate quantitative BDRL RPR results. Now, often when you go to these clinical sessions, you hear some very interesting questions, And during that session, one of the people in the audience remarked that those figures were probably an overestimate, since when the panel of tests comes to their clinic, they buy good tests to return, to do the test and then return the results, but carry on using bad tests locally. So that was interesting. So my last slide is just an acknowledgement to the team that helped put together the presentation, and a personal thank you from the international delegates to our hosts and for the incredibly warm welcome we've received and the wonderful hospitality. Thank you.
Excellent. Having had the responsibility to do rapporteur work at a couple of their meetings, I know how difficult it is, especially to do a good job, and I think these four did an extremely good job. I'd like to give them another hand.